Welcome to the Impact Equals podcast, in which we explore the impact investment industry, what it is, why it matters, and how it is playing a key role in reshaping how business is undertaken in many parts of the world. I've been presenting the Impact Equals podcast for nearly 2 years, and during that time, the impact investment industry and the wider development finance community has seen some incredibly significant changes. The last few months have been no exception. International development budgets have been cut by many governments, including in the UK and several across Europe. And events in Washington have, if you will excuse the obvious pun, trumped everything else. The new US administration has dramatically reduced the function of USAID, and there are questions hanging over the future direction of DFC, the US Development Finance Institution. The long and the short of it all is that there's less public capital available for international development. Against this backdrop of uncertainty, the need to mobilize private capital for international development has never been greater or more obvious. How does the impact investment industry and the development finance community work to accelerate the flow of private capital, the vast pools of money sitting in pension funds, life insurers, and so on? My guest today has some unique insights into answering that key question. Joan Larrea is the chief executive of Convergence, the global network for blended finance. Her role is to increase private investment in emerging markets and developing economies to advance the UN Sustainable Development Goals and Paris Agreement. Joan, welcome to the Impact Equals podcast.
Thank you very much. Excited to be here.
It's great to have you with us all the way from the US. Look, we try to untangle some of the more complex aspects of impact investing. So perhaps you could start by explaining what blended finance is and why it's so important.
Sure. First of all, it's not a synonym for impact investing, and I should probably point that out. There are impact investors who use blended finance, but what blended finance actually is a structuring approach. And in that approach, you take catalytic money, concessional money, money that is not operating on full market principles. It is seeking impact. And you place it adjacent to or in companionship with commercial money, money that is seeking a return. The point of doing that is in service of the SDGs, basically the Sustainable Development Goals, to try to create a new lane of traffic, a lane of investment traffic that would not ordinarily happen. So a good blended finance transaction has a couple of features, such as it wouldn't have happened without that blend. There is good impact, and there is actually some kind of cash flow that delivers a return to the commercial investor. So that's all blended finance is. It's a structuring device. Impacting investors can use it. Pension funds can use it. People who have no interest at all in impact may very well go into a structured financing that is blended where somebody else is seeking impact, because with the introduction of that other money, suddenly the risks and the rewards are in balance. And the reason it's important is because there is just simply not enough investment capital flowing into or operating well inside a lot of emerging markets and developing economies. So we really do need that third lane of traffic. We really do need to amp up the money that is investing in things that promote, a responsible approach to climate change, promote alleviation of poverty, promote all the SDGs, all 17 of them. So that's why it's important.
And just explain to our audience what the role of Convergence is.
I'd be glad to. So we were established at the time that the Sustainable Development Goals were promulgated. And the idea behind Convergence, which operates as an independent not-for-profit, and we are a proud Canadian company, although I'm sitting in Washington, D.C., the idea behind Convergence was to create a global network for blended finance. And as what we hope to be the hub in the middle of that field, we educate the practitioners in the field. We have the best data there is out there, deal by deal, on what has happened in this field. And you can see an expression of that in our annual State of Blended Finance reports. We do one for climate and one for the full field. So we educate everybody on what is going on. We operate very much from a data-driven approach. Second thing we do is try to guide the field. We have opinions on what it looks like and what it should look like. The third thing we try to do, and we operate on a membership model, we try to connect the practitioners to each other. You can imagine in the normal course of business, there may be no reason for Citibank to talk to a fund manager or a fund manager to talk to BII. That one makes more sense naturally, But would a fund manager talk to Rockefeller Foundation normally? Probably not, but all of these are components. All of these are players in blended finance. So we try to connect everybody to each other. And we also try to speed up action in the field. We really measure ourselves by how many transactions closed that use blended finance in the field, whether or not we had a big role. If these are members of ours moving money, we count that toward our measurement of ourselves.
In the introduction to the podcast, briefly mentioned the fact that the DFIs and others in international development are, you know, energetically looking at ways in which the concessionary capital that they provide can go further. How do you see blended finance sitting into that?
Blended finance is still a fairly small proportion of what official donor agencies do. It's a couple of percentage points of their cash flows, but it's very powerful stuff. If you look at what happened in 2023, the last year for which we have full information, we saw about $18 billion worth of transactions happen, a big jump up from about eight in the climate space. And each of those is propelled by some kind of catalytic money, whether it's ODA or not. A good, 70% of the transactions in our field have a DFI behind them to a multilateral bank or a bilateral bank. So institutions like BII using trust fund money and using ODA, official development aid, in blended finance transactions, they are a big part of the story of this field.
I mean, $18 billion is a lot of money in anyone's book, but in the grander scheme of things, in the kind of the global picture, and when you look at the kind of the size, the magnitude of the funding gap that exists in trying to meet the SDGs, it's not a huge figure. What are the kind of the obstacles to greater adoption of blended finance?
First of all, you're right. The problem exists in the trillions, and the amount of investment capital out there notionally that could be aimed in this direction is in the hundreds of trillions. Yet we're talking billions in blended finance, and that's one of the criticisms of the field is, you didn't deliver the billions to trillions. Well, it was only one device among a whole bunch of other things that have to go right, such as regulatory reform and good macroeconomic conditions. So you're right on the scale. I think the question you asked me just now, Andrew, was what has to change for it to get a lot bigger? Was that the question?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably fair to say that the ambition for blended finance has probably got ahead of the amount of or the scale of the capital committed. So, yeah, I guess that's the question: is how do you kind of accelerate those flows of capital?
Yeah, the field is growing at, maybe 4% a year if you look at the last 10 years on average, although there's a big jump 2022 to 2023. So that is not going to deliver trillions. There are a few things that are happening. One is the macroeconomic environment. Let's not forget that blended finance is the intersection of a lot of foreign direct investment and financial flows and development assistance. Development assistance in blended finance has been flat for several years. It has not grown. So that's one issue. And the investor appetite for emerging markets has also been very weak or going backward. So you can imagine because of those two flows themselves reducing, the intersection between them also can't grow very well. However, there are also things inside blended finance that need to be improved. We need to get really, really smart about each dollar of that catalytic money. We need to figure out how to use it to propel more dollars worth of commercial money per dollar. And I don't say that as if dollars is the way you measure success, but it is a proxy for other things. It's a proxy for other things going well. And it is a proxy for impact. Not a great one, but it is one. So inside blended finance, what needs to go better is the efficiency with which the catalytic money is used, the speed at which it goes out the door, the clarity about what it is that the donor community is seeking. You know, I keep talking about it needs to hang a shingle out the door. Like, we need to know if you go to Rockefeller Foundation or FCDO or DFAT Australia, what it is they're interested in and what it is they offer. None of that is going that well right now. Some agencies are really stepping forward, but it's still quite opaque. So the efficiency of the use of ODA has to improve massively. We also probably need to look at, since so much ODA is in the hands of development banks, be they DFIs or multilateral development banks, how are they using the money? They are very good stewards of money. I don't mean to imply anything there. But are they doing everything they can to use blended finance to mobilize third-party money, or are they just constructing good, solid development transactions in which they are the money? I think we need to get more into them creating structures that are appetizing for pension funds or who knows who, but, you know, the institutional money out there. Okay. So the field has to get better at what it does.
I want to unpack that in due course, but just to come on to that, your point, is there, from where you're sitting, is there a greater appetite on the part of private institutions to put money into blended finance vehicles if there was more concessionary capital available? Is that the kind of the equation that you're seeing?
Yes, but also if it were easier to get to it.
Right.
What we have seen is that when you get to the mega transactions, the ones that are over $1 billion in transaction size, those tend to have more leverage. What I mean is not leverage as a financial person, but more dollars of commercial money per dollar of gentle money, if you will. You see more leverage in large deals, whereas the field is at about 1 to 4. The really seriously large transactions are at about 1 to 9. So it isn't necessarily true that it's just the shortage of catalytic money that is the problem. It's also the shape and the availability and the rules around it that are issues.
Does that reality mean that the blended finance, all the big ticket blended finance vehicles, are they naturally going to be more directed at kind of those sort of middle income countries where there are those bigger projects available?
Possibly. So the entire field of blended finance, the average or the median transaction size, I have to check my facts, but somewhere around $56 million. So the median transaction is pretty small right now. And already the field lands more often in the low and middle income, the lower middle income countries than in the LDCs, the least developed countries. So already there's a pattern, and it makes sense because private investment has a much, much harder time going to a deeply impoverished nation, which is a very small place where the transactions are really small, than it does going to a larger economy that has a little bit more underpinnings, if you will, for an investor. So the field already is at a small scale and in the lower middle income countries. The mega deals, the whales, happen not just in those geographies, but they happen because they are diversified. So if you look, there have been a couple times where development banks have set aside, structured a way to set aside a slice of each of their inbound transactions over a number of years, put that slice in a separate vehicle, have investors be in that vehicle in a senior tier so that they are protected, and put a whole bunch of assets into that vehicle, not necessarily in middle-income countries. Because it's so diversified, because it's a solid, steady stream of transactions from a known player, it is interesting to the institutional investors. I'm thinking of the transaction IFC did originally a number of years ago and added to that's now at like $1.6 billion, which is the, I'm going to jumble the name, MCPP, the Managed Co-Investment Portfolio Platform Partnership, I think it is. And then more recently, and that one was blended. It had Swedish CEDA providing a guarantee of the junior tier of that. So that needed that kind of help. And the other more recent one was done by FMO, and MacArthur Foundation, which gave a guarantee to underpin the separate slice, this separate entity that was going to hold a whole bunch of FMO transactions as they came in. So long-winded answer, but the large ones aren't necessarily only in wealthier countries. The large ones have the virtue of diversification, consolidation, aggregation, and that's really attractive to investors. If you tell me I have to take a slice of a scary thing, I'm going to be much more reticent than if you tell me it's a slice of 52 scary things, because the odds are that they cannot all collapse on the same day. Therefore, I'm already, by virtue of diversification, I'm already in a better situation.
And just to come back to your other point about DFIs and in particular kind of needing to work more efficiently with their capital, I think most DFIs now are coming to the conclusion that future finance might be harder to come by from their respective governments. Does this mean there's naturally a kind of a movement towards greater investment in blended finance propositions?
I can't read their minds, but what I see is pressure on development banks to mobilize more, and that pressure comes from their shareholders. Remember, that's who they answer to, is the governments that set them up. So if you are a development bank and you have more pressure on you to mobilize third-party capital into your operations, I'm hoping that means that when they are in charge of concessional resources, they will start asking the question, how do I design that blended operation to invite in third-party money? My observation from the outside, I've been on the inside of two development banks, but I now am an outsider. My observation is, historically, development banks tee up their most solid investments and invite private sector investors into those. The ones that are in middle-income countries are a very known terrain. And they do blended finance for the more risky operations where they themselves feel that their mandate is stretched. What I would like to see with the increasing pressure on them to mobilize and the increasing scarcity of resources is that they put these two things together. How do I do a blended deal that has some risk features that we can shave off with concessional money and also design them in a really standard way so that private sector parties can join us? So that deal doesn't exist that often, and I'd really like to see that.
Okay. You mentioned that design in a standard way. I mean, that is part of the challenge, isn't it? Because blended finance vehicles tend to be, I guess, by definition, quite complex, quite expensive to put together. The whole industry needs to make it easier and simpler for everyone to be involved, doesn't it?
You need a job at Convergence, Andrew. That's my line. So we are working on a project right now on this whole subject of scale and standardization. And what we are saying to the field, remember I said we educate and we guide and we connect and we mobilize. So this is on the guiding side. Our observation is that over time, there have been some things that tended to move a lot of capital and are repeatable. And we'd like to propose a standard shape of these, say 12 types of approaches, get commentary from the field, all sorts of stakeholders. Are we on the right path or do we have these wrong? And that's what we're doing right now, is inviting commentary. But here are 12 standardized models that we think will move capital at scale. And we're also saying to the donors, could you possibly coalesce around these 12 and try to organize yourselves so that you are supporting these 12 models, each of which has different objectives. Some talk about local capital mobilization. Some are all about creating more projects to prime the pipeline for large scaled aggregation vehicles. So we really would like to see less bespoke, less wonky, less tailored transactions, and we'd like to see things rolling out faster and more standardized. The analogy I always draw is in the project finance world, you're going to build a water treatment plant, or you're going to build a power plant. Everybody knows the deal. There's going to be a construction contract. There's going to be a management contract. There's going to be an offtake contract. There's going to be a tariff regime. There are some really, there's going to be force majeure clauses. There's going to be, you know, material adverse change clauses, and everybody knows what these are. And yes, a water treatment plant in Malawi looks radically different from a power plant in Spain. But I guarantee you the lawyers will start on page 20 because they know what they're walking into, and you can get that deal done more quickly. We need blended finance structures to be like, oh, this is a number two, you know, this is a number six. I've seen one of these. It takes some radical rethinking. I think donors who want to see impact measured specifically their way or have very, very tight requirements on geography or whatever, they're going to have to bend a bit to get things done more speedily. We are moving too slowly. And in the private sector, you have an opportunity, you see a window, you've got maybe 6 months to move on it. And every other thing in your investment committee's docket can move in 6 months. How the heck are we going to compete with that, the attention of that investment committee, with something that takes 4 years and maybe falls flat? It just in the end can't be done because you can't squeeze everybody's requirements into the transaction. We've got to get past this somehow.
How do you achieve that, though? How do you get all the major players in a room together and thrash this out? I mean, what's the sort of the process for doing that? I mean, it must be a bit like herding cats, isn't it?
Yes. We can't tell anybody what to do. My observation from the beginnings of Convergence, we did a couple of things that we just thought were really sensible very early on. We just said, look, there are really only four kinds of blended finance deals, and they look like this. And people start to talk about the convergence archetypes. And it's not that we've changed the field, but we've simplified the original conversation about what actually qualifies as blended finance. I'd like to see that in this scale standardization project too. We can't command people to do standardization or commit to standard structures. But let's introduce the topic and let's all at least bat these things around and see whether they are they real or not. So the way we're doing it is, we're going to be publishing all these on our website, publishing the rationale behind the project on our website, inviting commentary from the governments of these countries, from donor governments, from institutional investors, from impact investors, from people who do public-private partnerships, all sorts of nooks and crannies of our universe. We're inviting people to come at us and talk about. I think just talking about organizing principles has a really salutary effect on just clearing the fog.
You've got Finance for Development coming up in Seville.
Yes.
Is that the next big opportunity to sit around the table and discuss these issues?
Yes, we are going to be presenting what we have so far at that event. And I know that BII also will be, by the way, backing up just a second, BII is also doing some great work, and I'm looking forward to the publication of something I've seen in draft, which is BII looking back at what it has done and suggesting that there are patterns. And that's a great start to a standardization exercise. If you know that most of the things that got through your process and did well had certain features and certain terms, that's a really helpful thing too. So I'm looking forward to that. And I think it's very, very complementary to what we as a field builder are trying to do.
Okay. Let's just take a step back slightly. Obviously there's huge pressures in the US and globally on aid and ODA budgets more generally. And I guess that means there is a growing tension in how scarce public finance and public capital is allocated. Where do you sit in the kind of the looking at the kind of big picture question of how best to allocate that increasingly scarce resource? Where does investment have the principal role, or is even the role of investment in this context changing?
It's so hard to see through the the chaos right now. So I unfortunately, my crystal ball has a lot of fuzz in it right now, a lot of hazy stuff in it. I live in the real world with you. So I know that aid has a lot of different strains on it right now, including security issues and defense issues, humanitarian issues. We have probably an unprecedented number of people displaced inside their countries and in other countries right now. It's got to be well over 60, 70 million. I am not sure of the figure there, but it's huge. So I live in that real world. That said, we do have to plan for the what next, the what after. How do people go on with their lives? And in the history of mankind, it is private sector growth that has propelled a return to stability, a return to growth. So I do hope that there remains, you know, attention to this objective as well. What it does mean is that donor agencies who wish to continue supporting the world of investment in people and in planet probably are going to have to look for very pared down approaches and pick a few strategic things to do and do them well. And that goes back to what I was saying also about being very laser focused on the efficiency of each dollar going out the door and the process by which you decide how those dollars go out the door. It is not going to be the same world. There's going to be scarcity, not just in the donor community, but I can foresee it in the multilateral development banks, the bilateral development banks as well. They're all going to have to realize, or they must already realize, I don't need to say it that way. They're all going to have to deal with the fact that other people's money is incredibly important. Getting other people's money into your transactions and maybe accidentally doing your work is going to be more and more important than it ever has been.
Do to use your term, other people recognize the opportunity to be more involved than they have been in the past?
So the appetite for global investors in the global South is not great when ambient risk is high, right? You come home to safety. That said, there is a huge opportunity there for diversification, for uncorrelated returns, for growth opportunities. The growth economies of the world are actually not the US or Germany or, you know, Spain. They are actually many countries of Africa and many countries that are still coming up in Asia. Investors will look at those places. The problem is that the risk is too high for the opportunity set. So there's a lot of positive financial return opportunities available in all of these developing economies. The problem is that the risk is not commensurate. The return is not commensurate with the risk. So as donor agencies and as philanthropies who are trying to do blended finance deal with that reality, they have to be thinking of how to de-risk, not just a company, not perhaps improve returns, but also literally de-risk, take some risk off the table from the point of view of these investors. There are so many of the countries we work in where the sovereign credit rating doesn't exist or is so low that it's just a no-go for certain investors. That takes some structuring to get that transaction back in onto the table to have a conversation about. That's not true for every country. There are many countries that do have, you know, and that are investable on the face of it, and it would take less blending to get a transaction done or none. But there are an awful lot where the risk profile needs to be modulated. So there are investors who are interested in this stuff. They're not going to move if the risk profile is high. The risk profile is particularly high right now, and there is your problem set. How do you adjust for that?
Yeah. I guess a lot of people would ask the question, why should essentially taxpayers at the end of the day underwrite the risk for private investors to essentially do the right thing, right? The world is facing some monumental challenges in development and in climate. Why should taxpayers, donor agencies, philanthropists underwrite the risk for private investors. Why shouldn't private investors just cut their cloth a bit and do the right thing and accept a lower rate of return?
Private money has choices to make. It's a little bit like water, right? It'll flow to the most logical destination. So left to itself, private portfolio investors look around and say, what's the risk on that? What's the potential return on that? And they draw a graph. And as long as it's, you know, risk-adjusted returns are what they were told to go do, they do it. They are dealing with your pension fund money, my life insurance money. They're fiduciaries. They're supposed to do the right thing for me. They're not, I'm not okay with my pension fund or my mom's retirement check running off and doing something outrageously risky for the good of mankind. I mean, we each expect these institutional investors to manage our money sensibly. So that's their starting point. If you are in charge of philanthropic money or taxpayer money, your starting point is, how do I get the most out of this dollar? How do the most impact? I don't care if the dollar comes back to me, but I want lots of people vaccinated or lots of people educated or lots of people to have a job opportunity or access to finance, because I think that's the right thing to do, because I think it's stabilizing for the planet, because I think we have a climate crisis, whatever motivates me. So the intersection there is, if I think my dollar bill will have five more dollar bills join it in doing what I think is important, I'll put my dollar bill down and de-risk that fat capitalist over there, because I'm going to get five of his bucks working on my issue. Maybe accidentally, maybe all they're looking at, that fat capitalist, is you know, the risk and the return look great. I'm going to go do that. So sometimes in blended finance, we have these odd conversations where somebody was totally on board, their catalytic money was going to be out the door and never come back to them, and they were good with that. And then you tell them you can add five more dollars to your ambition, and they're good with that. And then you say, and the other guy's going to make a little money here, or a lot of money here possibly. And somehow now the allergic reaction forms. It's unfortunate, because you can actually, both things can be true. Mm-hmm. You can be subsidizing somebody and getting more for your taxpayer money, if you do it right, if you do your own due diligence from your impact perspective. So there's a problem there in thinking that it's zero sum, that if somebody makes money, I must have done the wrong thing with taxpayer money. But you cannot make private sector investment capital do unnatural things, because those people would get fired for not taking care of my mom's pension check properly. Mm-hmm. You've got to solve for both at the same time. And where that's not possible, the deal's not possible.
Clearly, the dismantling of USAID is going to have some far-reaching implications for everyone who is involved in international development and development finance. What do you think are the kind of the longer-term implications of what's happening at the moment?
I mentioned in an interview in Environmental Finance a few weeks back, that USA falling was akin to having the biggest tree in a forest come down. But it's just a single tree, right? So the corollary is that there is a moment of opportunity. You know, the rest of the ecosystem is left in the glaring sun in that patch of the forest. So I think there is an opportunity for other nations that have aid programs to step forward and rethink about leadership. And I would really hope that others take on more of a leadership role in the absence of USAID. And in this moment of scarcity that we've already talked about, they're going to have to figure out what's mission critical and where they can lead. I would hope that we see more alliances, say between the Nordics or between others, of donors pulling in concert, shedding some of their individual requirements, opening up almost auction style processes where they collaboratively invite in proposals from moving private investment. I would love to see leadership of and collective leadership of the remaining players in the official development community. What I don't see happening, and I just want to point that out, and I think others are coming to the same conclusion, is that philanthropy can't fill this gap. I don't care how much money somebody has, the scale is wrong. In blended finance, we mentioned the scale of the entire field. We only ever see about, I don't know, $50 million a year or so of philanthropic money going into blended finance. It's a very small proportion. It does amazing things when it's there. Very small doses of philanthropic money have done some very cool things, and they take very early stage, very risky, very catalytic positions. So congrats to them.
Can you give an example? Yeah. Can you give an example of that?
Sure. The transaction I mentioned a little earlier where FMO and MacArthur Foundation got together, that's a $1.1 billion transaction, which has the likes of Allianz in it. I mean, some serious investors at the top of it. And it took a $25 million guarantee from MacArthur that didn't even write a check. They just made a guarantee of $25 million that got the whole thing off the starting line. That's powerful. They've also done some amazing things in disruptive early stage investing that has later become, look at microfinance. Microfinance started out very philanthropic and now is a legitimate asset class. So they do amazing things, but they are not the replacement. So there is still that bright spot in the forest where other donors, I hope, will grow into a new role together and, you know, take on some challenges with new energy and new realization that they're it. If not for them, really things won't go forward in the way we all need them to.
Joan, look, it's been a great pleasure having you on the Impact Equals podcast. Thank you so much for your time. It's been a fascinating chat.
It's been great to talk with you, and thank you so much for the opportunity.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, till the next time, thank you.